Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. Is everything in the universe interconnected? The assumption that it must be, and that with enough persistence, scientists will arrive at an elegant, unified theory, lies at the heart of contemporary physics. But what if the most brilliant minds in science are searching for something that simply does not exist? How would that realization change our sense of ourselves and our relative importance in the universe? Marcelo Gleiser is professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College. He explores these questions in his new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe. Marcelo, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
You write about the limitations of what you call monotheistic science. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. This story goes way back into the past. And if you actually want to know the beginnings of it, you have to go even before science. You have to go to the origins of philosophy. So you go to Greece 2,500 years ago, and you find the people there are the first to be asking questions about nature. And the first thing they asked was, what is the world made of? And their answers, which is really what matters to us, is that the world is made of a single substance. There is a oneness to the world. And since then, this concept of oneness, that behind the apparent complexity of the world, you actually can find some kind of hidden code where things are simple, has been with science and philosophy ever since.
And ultimately, you find that scientific dogma is not so different from religious dogma.
Well, we have to be careful because in the end of the game, science is related to the world, to reality, in the sense that we have to make experiments to prove or disprove our ideas. So I wouldn't call the search for unification or what people tend to call the theory of everything or a final theory as dogma, but I would call it an extremely persistent idea, which is based on more faith than evidence. And this is what's really interesting, because if you look at how this idea percolated through the centuries, you go through the Renaissance and you see the patriarchs of modern science, like Galileo and Kepler and Newton, they all searched for this kind of simple or unifying explanation of the world. And it's definitely true that science benefits tremendously from these simplifications, right? I mean, I would be crazy as a physicist to say that symmetry and such notions of order are not important. They are really very important. I mean, a lot of what we do is related to the laws of nature, right? Things that we can apply everywhere in space and any time in the history of the universe. So these things are very precious to us. But the problem is when you try to find some kind of law of laws, so to speak, you know, the code of codes, the center of everything. And there is where the faith on this idea becomes stronger than the evidence that we have that this really exists.
It is a fascinating time to be alive in that you now have science searching for answers to what at one time were exclusively religious questions.
That is definitely true, and I'm so excited about it because when I was a kid, I actually was a very sort of a mystic boy, and I actually, in the book, I'm very autobiographic, especially in the beginning. I tell people why I got into science and why I was also a unifier. That was my thing. I actually got into science because I was fascinated by these questions, precisely because I grew up a little disillusioned with religion and all the problems that religion and history had, you know, all the wars and things like that, and I was still looking for answers to my deep questions about existence. You know, where did the world come from? Is there a meaning to being human in this universe? And then I realized that science was dealing with similar questions, that modern science was trying to understand the origin of the universe, the so-called Big Bang Theory. And some of the most cutting-edge problems in science are indeed related to questions that people go to religion to find out. The origin of the world. So you go, for example, in the Western tradition, you go to Genesis, right, to find something about that. And then you have the origin of life and the origin of mind, you know, where does consciousness come from? So these questions, which have been for millennia, really, in the realm of religion are now legitimate scientific questions, and that I find quite fascinating.
Will it be possible for us someday to comprehend the origins of the universe without a unified theory?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's sort of like one of the key questions in the book. And in order to really understand that, we have to think about what does it mean, the origin of the universe, right? The origin of everything. It is a really complicated question. And in fact, I wrote a book a few years ago, which was actually my first book, which is called The Dancing Universe, which is a book about this question, you know, how different cultures across history try to answer this, and how does science have tried to deal with this same question? Because it's very complicated. You want to know where everything comes from, and you have to say, well, if everything is coming from something, then that something should be part of everything. And what did that something come from, right? And you say, well, there's this funny Hindu story that you say, well, it's easy. You know, you had elephants, and the elephants were standing on top of turtles, and then it's turtles all the way down, right? Meaning you can never really figure out this question. And in philosophy, this is the problem. It's called the problem of the first cause, right? You need sort of the initial kick, if you want, in order to get things in motion. And science, and this is a very, very important point, science does not have all the answers because it needs a structure in which to function. So we come up with hypotheses, and we have to create these hypotheses. They don't exist in a vacuum. You know, they come from theories that we have, which are based on laws of nature. For example, one of the sacred laws of physics is that energy is conserved always. So in everything we do, if you put gas in your car to make the car move, we are using the stored chemical energy in the molecules of the gasoline to make motion energy, the kinetic energy of your car. So there is a transformation there. But you cannot create energy out of nothing. So there are these laws that we have to use. So even a scientific explanation of the world has to be based on these laws, has to be based on our models to explain reality. So you could legitimately say, well, and where do these laws come from? You know, where, why is the universe this way and not another way? And you can go and you can come up with some answers, but the reality is that these answers cannot be verified empirically. That is, you cannot test them. And when you can't test something, then you're not doing physics anymore. You're doing metaphysics.
Well, what you write here that I had never really thought about before, but I find it fascinating, is that just because humans can't create something out of nothing doesn't mean the universe can't.
It's true. But then you have to ask a question, well, how do you know these things? You know, and this is another very important point, which in a sense, my book, if you're not careful, you say, well, this guy is shooting down science. And I'm like, absolutely not. I'm making science what it really is, in the sense of without glorifying it, you know, in ways that it shouldn't be glorified. And one thing which is a very, very important point in the book is, how do we know what we know about the world, right? Well, if you are just a person, you look out and you can see, for example, you go out at night, probably far away from the downtown Dallas in the center, and you're going to see in the countryside a bunch of stars. And you say, wow, look at all these stars. Now, if you have tools, you can see many, many more stars, right? And if you have a microscope, you can see things which are completely invisible to our eyes. So the way we do science, the way we construct or build up our knowledge of physical reality is through our instruments, through our tools. Now, it's definitely true that in the last 400 years, our tools have advanced tremendously. And now we can see super far away into the universe and super deep into the heart of matter with our amazing machines. But even then, those tools have limitations. They are not infinitely powerful, which means something very deep and very important, which is the following. Even though we are amazingly creative things, we humans, the information that we have about the world is always going to be limited by the precision of our machines, of our tools. And that means that we will never know all there is to know about reality. And if you don't know all there is to know about reality, you can never, ever be sure that whatever theory that you have that you're claiming is the final theory really is the final theory, because there's all this darkness out there, the stuff that we don't know, and the stuff that we don't know may be putting all this so-called final theory into check. And so we can never, ever be sure that what we call a final theory truly is, simply because we never will know all there is to know.
As you were coming to this realization in your mind, Marcelo, as a physicist, did you struggle against it for a while?
I really did. I really did, because, you know, I grew up thinking that science was this all-powerful and could really come up with the theory of everything. And you know, in the book, I use this metaphor, which is not actually not my metaphor. It's a metaphor that other people like Kepler and Newton, and even more recently Stephen Hawking, you know, the famous physicist from England, has used, which is the following, that if we understand all there is to be understood in nature, we'll really be reading the mind of God. Hmm. So there was this metaphor. Well, for Newton and for Kepler, it wasn't a metaphor. It was the real deal, because they said that the world is created by God, and the more we understand of the world, the more we are going to be understanding of God. And hence, for them, doing science was really like doing theology. You know, they really wanted to understand more about the world, the God, through their science. But then, for other scientists, you know, they are not religious in that way, the metaphor remained. So it's fascinating with this idea. Wow, so there is some kind of secret code of nature, you know, and I will, through science, help understand it. And I did my PhD on this, on superstring theories. I did, you know, which we probably will talk about later on, and with things that exist in nine dimensions of space. And then I wrote, I don't know, dozens, 40, 50 papers on the topic. And suddenly I started to look around, and it had a lot to do with maybe, you know, growing a little older, being a little more mature, looking at what my colleagues were doing, and also moving to the northeastern countryside, which is where I moved about 9 years ago. And I live in the middle of this gorgeous place, middle of a forest, where I'm really exposed to nature all the time. And I started to think of what people were saying, what my papers were saying. I said, but wait a second, where is this all coming from? You know, where is the evidence, the true evidence, that there is such grand plan behind all there is to it? And then when you come down to it, and this is, of course, a 100-page argument in my book, you look of all the of what we have in terms of evidence, and we figure out that there is no evidence, that, yes, there have been partial unifications in the history of physics. For example, we talk about electromagnetism, right, the theory of electricity and magnetism as being a unified theory of these two different things, electricity and magnetism. And that is true. It is a beautiful unified theory, but it's not a perfect theory for all sorts of reasons. And so everywhere you go and you look, the things that we call unified are really just approximations. And then this whole notion that there is perfection in nature, and that this perfection is beautiful, and that this beauty is truth, starts to crumble down. And what you find instead is that nature creates through asymmetry. And is this asymmetry that is really responsible for all the richness that we see around us? So I start to realize that, and I start to get really prepared to change my mind. And that's what happened.
Marcelo Gleiser is my guest. He's professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Marcelo Gleiser. He is professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe. given the work that you have committed your life to, it would seem that arriving at the conclusion that there is no perfect single theory to explain the universe might be terrifying or at the very least depressing. But I have the sense reading the book that for you, it in many ways is liberating.
That's exactly right. I'm so glad you brought this up, because every time I talk to people about what the main idea of the book is, look, there is no grand plan out there. You know, we are not the result of some purpose, creation of some kind. People say, but then if that's true, what's the meaning of life? You know, it becomes like if we are the result of accidents, of these asymmetries that happen all the way from the origin of the universe to the origin of matter, and then, as I explain on the second part of the book, to the origin of life itself, what's the meaning of it, right? So people get into this sort of existentialist dread. And I'm like, no, you're getting this wrong. This is what people used to think. But if you actually start to think about what the book is truly saying, and when you look at what life and what we know about life is really really means to us, then you completely change your mind. And this is how it goes. What we have found out, now moving from, say, physics to more biology and the history of the planet Earth and life on Earth, what we found out here is that for life to develop, it had to go through all sorts of very complicated obstacles. And all of them are very difficult to reproduce, let's put it that way. They depend on detailed circumstances of what was going on at that particular time. So life started when a bunch of chemicals about 3.5 billion years ago decided to self-organize and start to reproduce and also to metabolize energy from the outside, from the environment. And then you start creating the first living forms. And what's really amazing is that now we actually know a little bit about the history of life on Earth, and we can put some numbers into this. And what we find is the following, is that starting at 3.5 billion years ago, for about 3 billion years is a hell of a long time, for about 3 billion years, life was only basically unicellular, amoeba-like animals, okay? Very, very simple life forms. Now, those little guys, those little life forms, they actually transformed the Earth completely, because at some point, we think about 3 billion years or so, they discovered photosynthesis. They discovered that they could use the energy from the sun and transform their internal metabolism so they could create energy for themselves and put out oxygen. So before their time, there was no oxygen on the atmosphere of the Earth, and life, just complex life, just couldn't exist. Turns out that life as we know it, at least, needs oxygen, because oxygen is like the granola bar of biochemistry. It gives a huge amount of energy to all sorts of reactions to go on. And so these little guys essentially transformed the Earth, made it an oxygen-rich atmosphere, created the ozone layer that blocked the ultraviolet rays from the sun so that more complicated life forms could survive without being radiated by that stuff. And eventually more, you know, multicellular organisms formed. And about 200 million years ago, you start getting the dinosaurs and the more big, complex things. Now you say, okay, the dinosaurs. Well, they are an example of how life is really only interested in adapting itself, that it doesn't have sort of a linear direction towards more and more complexity. Because, you know, people think, oh, if there is life somewhere, then just wait a while, and life is going to be very complicated, and eventually it's going to become intelligent. So people that believe in extraterrestrial intelligence would say, if you find life somewhere, then you're going to find intelligence. It's just a matter of time. And the history of life on Earth is not telling us this story. It's telling us this, that life only cares about being well adapted to its environment. So our little guys, the unicellular organisms, they were very well adapted for 3 billion years, roughly. That's all there was. But then the conditions changed, right? The oxygen in the atmosphere changed. Continents started to be made. and eventually more complicated organisms were developed. And you look at the dinosaurs, they survived for about 150 million years on Earth. That's a long, long time. Compare that to our mere 200,000 years. Okay, that's nothing compared to 150 million years. And yet, they were not very smart. As far as we know, dinosaurs are pretty stupid animals. They're big reptiles. They didn't create radios or technologies or anything like that. And so you say, oh, so you don't really have to be smart to survive a very long time. You just have to be well adapted. And yes, what happened 65 million years ago, a giant asteroid fell not very far from Dallas, actually, in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, and destroyed about 45% of the life on Earth, including all the dinosaurs. Meanwhile, the little mammals that were not very important at the time didn't have the predators to pester them, started to develop more. The conditions changed, the environment changed, and the mammals then developed faster and faster, and lo and behold, here we are now talking about these things. So what that means is the following, is that if I could play God and change a few accidents that happen on the long, long history of the Earth and of life on Earth, things would have been completely different. In particular, we probably wouldn't be here.
So if we accept that life, the existence of life, is a sort of glorious, wonderful, very fortunate accident, will that at some point bring us any closer to understanding why all life as we know it ultimately requires death?
Well, that's a difficult question, but I think you can't even think about life without death, in a sense, because life is a mechanism. You know, if you really think at the basic of the basics of what life is essentially a very complicated chemical network of reactions that has this remarkable ability to self-reproduce, right, to create copies of itself. And one of the things which is very clear about life is that this copy mechanism, right, what we nowadays call genetics, cannot be perfect. So whenever there are copying, there will be a probability that there will be mistakes. So we call these mistakes mutations. If the duplication of cells were perfect, if mutations didn't exist, then life wouldn't have the ability to reinvent itself and adapt itself to changing environments. You know, so if you're a reptile and the world became very, very cold, if there couldn't be some other forms of life that could adapt themselves to colder weather, that would be the end of life. So the fact that life existed all this time is precisely because it's imperfect, it goes through mutations, and it fails, so it dies. So living organisms, they must have death imprinted into their existence, so to speak.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Marcelo Gleiser is my guest. We're talking about his new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe. We'll go first on the phones here to Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, in a sense, when we argue or use logic, science is beholden to this, we think linearly or in a straight line, and it seems like you get into some of the extremes that these things bend. What if these things weren't linear but more parabolic? And, you know, at the parabola, you're kind of almost at the ends of it, you're almost totally perpendicular to where you started. And but it seems like the quantum world, as we get, you know, we're so limited in what we can see and observe here, it might all look like a segment or a line, but it seems to get distorted as we get into the extremes. Might there be something to that? Again, it's a human reasoning flaw. We don't appreciate acceleration and these types of, growth.
What do you think, Marcelo?
If I understood you well, basically, I let me see if I can translate that to my argument. So I would say that, yes, science and the way we understand the world is necessarily incomplete because we are incomplete creatures. So science is essentially an attempt to order all the stuff that we see in nature, you know, to make some sense of the complicated reality that we seem to exist in. And so it will have its flaws, and eventually You know, the beautiful thing, though, about science is that even though it is this sort of imperfect mechanism to understand reality, it corrects itself through experimentation. And so, yes, you know, linearity is not a good thing. And in fact, nonlinear thinking is much more exciting, and it seems to be the way to go these days in scientific thinking. But it's also true that science incrementally grows, meaning that knowledge grows as we develop better tools and as we develop better tests to test our theories. Now, I wanted to say one thing that I didn't say before, because you're saying, but then why is this a good thing about, you know, asymmetry? How does that make you feel liberated? And I ended up not completing that thought, and I think it's such an important point in the book that I should go back to it. And essentially, the idea is this. So if life is then really a sequence of accidents, then we are a remarkable accident. And we look at our planet and we compare Earth to the planets of the solar system. And what we see is that Earth is really an amazing oasis. No kidding that the Pandora, right, in the movie, mm-hmm. the movies made such a huge success because it really is a metaphor for our own planet. And so that makes us humans very, very important indeed. So instead of being, oh, we are nothing because we are accident, is we are everything because we are an accident. And because of that, we have a huge mission ahead of us, which is to preserve life and to preserve this planet at all costs.
We'll go next to Commerce and speak with Kenneth. Hello, Kenneth.
Hi. Yeah, first I'd like to just thank Dr. Glasser for his studies and his book. I haven't actually read it yet, but I look forward to reading it. I myself have struggled for quite some time with an uneducated belief that science. I'm what I refer to as a Christian scientist or upcoming scientist. I'm actually in school right now, but I've had this idea that science not only complements Christianity, but Christianity complements science, and I think that's kind of what this is all pointing towards. And I really just wanted to thank him. I don't have a whole lot of in-depth comment here, but I think that argument and struggle that has been and probably will be between those ends of the spectrum of explanation for the universe and everything in it is really complementary in nature. I just wanted to thank Dr. Glasser, and I appreciate it. I look forward to using his knowledge to support my claims and my arguments.
Thanks for your call.
You're very welcome. Yes.
You have been, although you are not religious yourself, you have been sort of turned off by the angry war between religion and science. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, this is sort of a recurring theme in my work and in my writings and all that. Well, I see the way some scientists like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and the journalist Christopher Hitchens and another guy, a philosopher called Daniel Dennett. We call them the Four Horsemen. These are sort of the radical atheists, right? The sort of the atheists that say that, you know, if you believe in God, you're delusional and that religion is an absurdity of humanity and it should be banished, that the only position which is tenable is the atheistic position. And they are quite militant about this, to the point of being incredibly aggressive in their arguments. And unfortunately, a lot of people think that they are speaking for all scientists, and they really are not. They are not the voice of science or scientists at all. Science has no hidden agenda to take God away from people. Now, what science does is try to create a narrative that explains the way the world works. Now, historically, it's true that as we understood more of nature, the presence of a God that could explain, for example, how the planets go around the sun or how the sun was born or why the sun shines and things like that. So this kind of God became less and less important. And there's no denying that. I mean, anybody that believes that the Earth is 6,700 years old is really closing his or her eyes, you know, to modern science even though they speak on their cell phones and, you know, et cetera. But so there are sort of radical positions which are equally bad either way. In the case of this radical atheism, I think even the notion of atheism is really scientifically untenable, because an atheist would categorically deny everything that has to do with the supernatural. And an agnostic, which is what I call myself, would say, look, I have absolutely no evidence that I trust to believe that there is something called supernatural tendencies or forces in the universe. However, since I don't know all there is to know, I am not in control of the totality of knowledge, I could not possibly deny what I do not know. So there is room there. There is some wiggle room, you know, for things that we don't understand to exist. Now, if you would ask me, I would say, well, I don't even understand what supernatural really means. You know, I think that I say that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the naturalists and the supernaturalists, right? So the naturalists are the ones, and I include myself in this group, of course, are the ones that think this way. Look, the world is very complicated. Our lives are very complicated. We don't understand all there is to understand. But the fact that we don't understand all there is to understand does not mean that what we don't understand has to be explained through supernatural causes, that is, causes which are beyond our understanding.
Marcelo Gleiser is my guest. He's professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Marcelo Gleiser, who is professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth. His new book is called A Tear at the Edge of Creation. Marcelo, does it make sense for scientists to continue searching for a unified theory, if only to prove, perhaps, your conclusion that one doesn't exist?
I think they should definitely continue. In the book, I'm really, really careful to say, look, I'm not going to tell people what they should or shouldn't do, but I would tell them to think critically about what they are doing. And so I think what we are finding is that unification, ideas of unification, of symmetry, they are incredibly important in physics, but as approximations. So even if you go and you develop some complicated theory that unifies all the forces of nature, they are going to be the forces of nature that we know now. They cannot be all the forces of nature, because we don't know what all the forces of nature are going to be. So even if they do this, I'll say to them, that's wonderful, but this is still going to be a partial unification. It's not going to be a complete theory or a theory of everything.
We'll go next to Larry in Fort Worth. Hi, Larry.
Well, hello there. I'm always so excited when you have a physics program.
Me too.
And I think this is such a fascinating idea, but it also seems a little bit antithetical to the way people think, you know, because we really are finders of patterns. And I'm reminded of some of the classic stories I've heard in particle physics about scientists failing to record events that didn't match their expectations, not because they were trying to cook the data, but because they literally didn't see the events that fell outside of their patterns. And so I guess my question for your guest is, how do scientists have to change the way they think and the way they manage their experimentation in order to accept that there may not always be a pattern to find?
That is a wonderful question, actually. And what I say in the book and what I think is the following, that there are notions of symmetry and there are notions of asymmetry. And in fact, we can get the cue from arts, you know, what happened to the arts in the 20th century. So if you go backwards, you know, say to the 17th and 18th century, painting and music were ordered, harmonic. They wanted to look at symmetric patterns and everything that was very easy to the eye and to the ear. And then you go into the 20th century, and you have people like Picasso, for example, destroying, so to speak, this order. And you have the atonal music of Schoenberg and others destroying the notion of tonality in music. And you have a new aesthetic. You know, you have a new aesthetic that moves away from perfection and this idea that perfect is truth to this notion that imperfection is beautiful as well. And in the book, I use this idea of Marilyn Monroe and her beauty mark. You know, you think of Marilyn Monroe, and she has this beauty mark, or Cindy Crawford, if you want, right? And they are more beautiful because of that. If you actually look at the face of a person, and you, if you could, and some computers actually have this nice little software that you can make two sides of your face being your left side or your right side, and you join them together, and you look horrendous, I promise you, because no human face is perfectly symmetric. So you're absolutely right when you say that we are pattern-seeking people, and we are indeed, and this has served us well, evolutionarily speaking, because, you know, if you're in the middle of a jungle and you see the and you see all the plants, but then suddenly there is a tiger moving there, you got to differentiate the tiger from the foliage. And so pattern identification is incredibly important to us. But these patterns are never exactly perfect. So what I'm saying is that you have to open your eyes to perhaps a new way of thinking about the role of what is asymmetric and imperfect in the world. And you're right, again, when you talk about particle physics and how people select what to look at and what not to look at. And there is a huge danger that the filters that we use to select data may take away what's really interesting and new because we're not even prepared to see it.
We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak with Manuel. Hi, Manuel.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I had a comment and I guess a question. I'm listening to the rhetoric that he's using, and I'm very moved by most of the things that he said. The problem is, and I'm sorry, I don't remember your number, that's why I'm not addressing you by name. But
Marcel.
The problem is that I see, I kind of understand a little bit the point that Dawkins and the Four Horsemen had, in the sense that religious have been, in my opinion, perniciously trusted into our consciousness. And if we utilize a language that gives them an opportunity to grasp onto it, like the caller that one of the first callers that you had, he was saying that it actually reaffirmed his Christianity and his science. They will grab onto it, and if I take it to the extreme, it will happen like in the Library of Alexandria, and one day they're going to raise arms, and all our science is going to be taken by extremist religious beliefs.
What do you think, Marcelo?
And I actually take your point, and I know that extremist orthodoxy in religion is a horrendous force in society, and I'm completely with you. I couldn't agree more. But on the other hand, there is a good that religion also does. You know, I know I grew up in Brazil where the Catholic Church is very strong, and you can say whatever you want about the Catholic. They're not very popular these days. But I know a lot of people that have been helped in many, many ways positively by, you know, the religious groups and grassroots movements and all sorts of identification. So you can argue that the state could be doing all these things, and I agree, the state could be doing all these things, but the fact is that the state often does not. And so there is a point to religion which I don't see how we could possibly get rid of, to put it that way. Also because humans are very spiritual. So what I try to do, okay, so this is my agenda now. So my agenda is to show that science and the way to relate to the world is also a deeply spiritual way, and that you do not need to believe in the supernatural in order to be a spiritual person. So I consider myself a spiritual person, and in fact, Richard Dawkins considers himself a spiritual person without having to embrace this notion that there is a supernatural realm out there that we cannot touch and we can have no control over, right? And so my message is, look, I'm not going to accuse religious people of being delirious, although I have to say that those which are orthodox, meaning extreme religious people, are somewhat delirious because they're not looking at what the world or science is telling them. But I will also respect the fact that people need some kind of emotional and spiritual help that science just cannot offer them.
Ollie in Dallas is our next caller. Hi, Ollie.
Hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I was just calling to ask Dr. Marcella a question in regards to the point he was hitting on with the in regards to the cellular structure and early life on the planet Earth. My question was, considering the complexity of the internal structures of a unicellular organism and things like the newly discovered nanobes, I don't know if that's been the validity of nanobes entirely, but do you feel that that DNA could have evolved somewhere else, or it could have been like a proto-DNA we're not totally aware of?
So that's a good question, and that speaks to the question of how rare life is in other planets, right, which is a topic that I address most to the end of the book. And the answer is this. If you have the basic chemicals, right, so if you have like nitrogen and oxygen and carbon and hydrogen, it doesn't take very much, and the experiments have demonstrated that, to make, say, simple amino acids. So amino acids, which are the things that make up proteins, and without proteins there'll be no life, at least life as we know it, they are not very hard to make. Now, nucleic acids, the stuff that makes up DNA and RNA, are tougher to make. We don't quite know exactly how to make them as the Earth was, say, 4 billion years ago. But the fact that we don't know how to make it doesn't mean that nature didn't know how to make it. So if you ask me, should there be life in other planets, you know, I would say, yes, there will be life in other planets. All you need is something that looks somewhat like Earth, so a rocky planet not too close and not too far from its main star. It has to have the right chemistry, and it has to survive long enough for life for these chemical reactions to develop and become complex. Now, if you say, okay, does that mean that you also believe that there is intelligent life all over the place? Then I would say no. I think that there may be definite life, but I'm not so sure about intelligent life. That's a much, much, much more complicated question.
How does our culture and our history affect the way we approach the study of how the universe might end?
Yes, and in fact, that's the second book I wrote. It's called The Prophet and the Astronomer. It's really a book about the end of the world, you know, and from a religious and then mostly from a scientific perspective, you know, how does science deal with these questions? And we, of course, because we live and die, we are fascinated and obsessed almost, I would say, with the question of death, right? How does it end? And it's very easy to transfer death to the planet itself and even to the universe. You know, will the universe survive forever? What's the story with that, given that it also had sort of like a birthday at the Big Bang? Will the universe exist forever or not? So these are, yes, these are questions which are at the forefront of science. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that the Earth is going to end, that the sun, we live close to a star, and the sun, as all other stars, do not shine forever. They have what we call a life cycle. And the life cycle of the sun is very clear. We understand it very well. We know how the sun produces its energy. And we also know that eventually the sun is going to run out of fuel. And that's going to happen in about 4.5 billion years from now, 5 billion years from now. And when that happens, the sun is going to explode, and it's going to grow, and it's going to swallow Mercury and Venus and come very, very close to the Earth. So we know that our days here are doomed, even though we're talking very, very far away into the future. But even in a billion years from now, which is still a long, long time, but in a billion years from now, the sun is going to be about 10% more luminous, brighter than it is now. And that's going to be way more than enough to basically melt the rocks and evaporate the oceans and make life as we know it completely impossible. So, yes, we do have answers to these questions.
Do you find the same kind of comfort in science today that you once might have found in religion as a child, or is it a different sort of reassurance that you get from your attempts to understand the natural world?
To be honest, I never found comfort and reassurance in religion. I was actually very anguished by the whole thing because it sounded so distant and so far away for me. You know, it was an absent God. It was something that I could not really put my hands on. And with science, I guess what has happened to me is that I started to make peace with ignorance, you know, make peace with the fact that we will never know all the answers. And to me, that's what makes me sleep at night now. It's not that I am afraid that if I die, I'm going to go to hell if I'm a bad guy, but I'm okay with the fact that we'll never know all there is to know. And in fact, that's a wonderful thing because it's by not knowing, by having questions, that we learn more about the world. So I kind of embrace the questions as the way to become a better person. And that's what I'm trying to do and what I'm trying to convince my friends about these questions that I'm discussing, you know, today in this program and in my book in general, to basically become a better person. And more than that, become a better species. I think humanity needs to go through a reset and understand its importance in a cosmic perspective, not just, you know, can I pay the bills at the end of the month, which is a problem that we all have, but can we preserve life here in this planet, and what can we do to make sure that it flourishes and becomes more than what it is now instead of destroying it the way we are.
Marcelo Gleiser is professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College. His new book is called A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe. Marcelo, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks, Chris, for having me. That was wonderful.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.